Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. A heavy emphasis on the theater this week, with playwright Kathy Rucker talking about her play Crystal Springs, which will receive its world premiere at the Eureka Theater this month. Conductor Dwayne Carroll shares details about the Contra Costa Wind Symphony's upcoming spring concert. Solo performer Jill Weiss talks about her Best of Fringe award-winning show, Tipped and Tipsy, now at the Marsh. And the first Thursday of the month means critic Joshua Cosman shares his classical music picks for the month ahead. Stay with us. The Eureka Theater presents the world premiere of Crystal Springs, a new play that interweaves the challenges of parenting in the digital age with a suspenseful tale of online misbehavior and its vicious consequences. It opens tomorrow at the Eureka and runs through the 23rd of the month. And the playwright Kathy Rucker now joins me in studio to talk about this. Kathy is a past member of the San Francisco Bay Area Theater Company Playground, and her first play, Beautiful Scar, was a finalist for the Heideman Award at the Humana Festival 10-Minute Play Contest. Among other awards, her play Done There, Been That was produced at the Birkenkeller Theater in Bristol, England, to great acclaim, directed by Natasha Harper Smith. Kathy, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, David.
So what is the play about? I've gotten a little bit of background about some online misbehavior, but why don't you give us a little synopsis first?
Well, the play has three different themes. The first one is the volatile relationship between moms and daughters during those perilous teenage years. And then, like you said in the beginning, it's about being a parent during the digital age. And also, it's about the quest to fit in, even if you're a teenager or a grown-up. So we're just weaving those three themes.
Inspired by real events, I imagine, some of it.
It's inspired by several real events, kind of pulled from today's headlines and kind of watching my daughter as she goes through her school years. She's 9 years old, and yeah, just our experiences.
It certainly isn't the era of our era of liquid crystal displays and monochrome monitors that take 20 minutes to light up, as I remember not even having an email account until I was in college.
Right, exactly.
So where does the fact end and the fiction begin?
The fiction begins with a lot of the details of the characters that I've created, the actual ending. And also the play, I have decided to do something different in the structure, which perhaps I shouldn't reveal on air and keep it for the theater goers. The relationships between the characters are fictionalized. But the idea of cyberbullying is something that we all read about in the papers today. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
And so how do you approach that in on both sides of the equation?
As a writer, I approached it, it was easy for me to do as a parent, because my daughter is at that time where she wants to have the cell phone, she wants to have the iPad, and I know it's only coming to us where she'll want to have social media. So, that's, for me, is a reality. And now I just lost my train of thought.
That's all right. So do you find yourself having to add restrictions or monitoring? How old is your daughter, by the way?
She's 9 years old, and yes. I mean,
wow, that's early to start in a whole digital life.
Well, she doesn't really have the digital life. She just wants it. I think it's peer pressure. But it's just something that we have to prepare for, because it's a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And So we're just, you know, she knows that there are two things that we have brought up to her. Number one, anything that goes on the internet's there forever. And the other thing that we emphasize is having empathy. You know, we've taught her about the golden rule, and it applies as you enter the age of digital technology. You know, we have to be empathetic to anything that we post and anything that you do. You have to be responsible and that there are consequences.
Absolutely. So tell us about your cast.
We have an amazing cast of six actresses from the Bay Area, and we also have an extremely talented director from London. The play is going to be produced in London in the fall. When I first started writing the play, I sent it to a friend of mine who's a director and writer in London to help me, to give me notes. And so we've been working together, and that's Anna Jordan. She's our director. And subsequent to this production, it will go to the Park Theatre in London.
Mm-hmm. Is it a conscious decision to have an all-female cast?
Well, the play started, there was a festival in London that I was asked to write a play for, and they asked the female playwrights to write about hate and to have six women in the cast. So that was that was the structure of the play that I had to write. And then the male writers were told to write about love, and they had to have six men in the cast. So that's how the play actually began. And then it just evolved. But we have found six amazing actresses. We're very excited with everyone that we have.
And how did you first get acquainted with British director Anna Jordan?
Ironically, through Facebook.
Oh, there. That works into the theme perfectly.
Yes, it does. Yeah, we did. She and I had both submitted plays to a theater's website, and she had been interviewed, and I read one of these interviews that she had given, and I friended her, and we just became friends since then, and she gave me some excellent notes on the play, and I really wanted to work with her, and I'm very happy that she was able to do this with me.
So how did that relationship evolve then, offering you notes rather spontaneously? Did you request, what do you think of this? And then how did it evolve to a full direction, and how did your work change?
Well, she had a, what you would call a script doctoring service. She has a theater company in London, and she offers that service. So I asked her, as a professional person, to read my script. She gave me amazing notes, which were very helpful for me to take it to the next level. And then when we were talking about getting a production, I couldn't, she was open to the idea, and just from her understanding from the very beginning of the play, I was very excited to work with her. She was very enthusiastic. She had a vision for it that, I found inspiring.
Can you share one of those eureka moments, so to speak, even though it is at the Eureka Theater, but earlier on for the play creation process, where you saw something that she just wrote a sentence that said, develop this character or go in this direction, and how it changed your original work?
Unfortunately, there's this one very crucial moment that I would love to share with you, but that would just blow the mystery of the play. It's the crucial dramatic moment.
Uh-huh.
So everyone will just have to come and see it.
So the play didn't have that direction before she came aboard?
It did, but Anna has a very, she has a very dark, dramatic side, and she kind of pushed me to another level. And I was appreciative because I needed to be pushed that way. I think she brought something to the play that I don't think I would have taken it, so she helped.
That's playwright Kathy Rucker talking about her work Crystal Springs, which is currently at the Eureka Theater. I believe this is your fourth or fifth play.
It's about my 10th.
Oh, your 10th. Goodness. Okay. So are the previous plays that you've been working on all inspired by personal experiences, or what's your inspiration for the playwriting process?
Inspiration comes from many different things, usually from small little articles in the newspaper. My last play was about a statue of the Virgin Mary that was taken to India and then kidnapped in an Indian train station. That was called Sultan's Battery. Then I recently did a play about a program that was implemented in the prison system about other prisoners taking care of prisoners with dementia. And then another play I did was about Alan Turing, a British mathematician during the Second World War.
And what's your current inspiration? What are you working on after Crystal Springs?
I don't know. The last few plays have been really dark, so I'd like to do something like, you know, a contemporary Harvey story, something with a big bunny or something.
Children and animals.
Yes, something a little bit lighter. So I'm not sure yet, because I really
and
you
an
have
option
to
Disney
well.
Might be good for that.
Yeah, yeah, excellent.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, I'll see what I can do. Get some context on that.
That would be great.
Well, thanks for taking a little time today to talk about Crystal Springs.
Thank you, David.
Kathy Rooker's Crystal Springs is receiving its world premiere at the Eureka Theater. It opens tomorrow evening and runs through the 23rd. The Eureka Theater is at 215 Jackson Street. Crystal Springs, a play that combines the challenges of parenting in the digital age with a suspenseful tale of what it's like to misbehave online and its consequences. Information for this play at the Eureka is at www.crystalspringstheplay.com. crystalspringstheplay.com. Thank you again to Kathy Rooker for coming in and talking about that. Still to come, Joshua Cosman's picks for the month of March at the end of the hour. Plus, I'll be talking with Duane Carroll about the Contra Costa Wind Symphony. And next up, Jill Weiss about her solo show at the Marsh. Stay with us.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my babe and one more for the road.
Frank Sinatra singing One More for the Road, an appropriate introduction, I think, to our next segment on Tipped and Tipsy. Jill Weiss's background includes a wide array of performances in physical comedy, mime, clown, improv, and live music, as well as film. She played the lead in the short film The Last Trip to Spain, which received the award for Best Short at the Portland, Maine Film Festival. She's also bartended at more than 28 bars and clubs in San Francisco, sometimes only for an evening. We'll find out more about that. And she's created this play based on that called Tipped and Tipsy. It's at the Marsh and supposed to be a touching and hilarious send-up of American bar culture. Jill Weiss joins me now in studio. Hi, Jill.
Hi, David.
So it sounds like we're in for quite a an evening.
Yes, yes. It is. It's a high-energy show, and it's just me.
You write that this play is written in part as an answer to a question that you always get, which is, so what is the craziest thing you've ever experienced working in a bar? So
yeah.
What is the craziest thing you've ever experienced in a bar, whether it's in the play or not?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because every day is just so crazy, you know, that you almost can't even remember what happens day to day. So many crazy things happen. I mean, just that people divulge their lives to you, you know, is pretty crazy. But, I can give you a little piece from the play.
Sure. Let's go off of that then.
On December 19th, 1998, in the midst of SantaCon, Mike Stone bought a bottle of peppermint schnapps, one shot at a time, and attempted to lift a car that had no one trapped beneath it. So that's one of the tales of alcohol-induced courage that...
Which leads me to the question, which is your other question that is part of the inspiration for writing the play, is have you ever had to cut someone off?
Oh, my God. I mean, almost every time you work, you have to cut someone off. I mean, right now I'm working at a nightclub, so that's a little different. You know, you definitely have to cut people off because it's just a larger volume. But, yeah, I've definitely had to cut a lot of people off. people that you grow to really care about. You know, I mean, there's two different kinds of cutoffs too, right? There's sort of, you're not allowed to drink here anymore, period. And then there's the much more typical one, which is just, you know, you've had enough for the day.
Right.
So that you experience a lot. But cutting someone off for the long haul, I've only had to do a couple times.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the volume of drinks involved in some of these clubs. I'm thinking about the other kind of volume, in that when I'm in a bar, maybe it's because of my years of piccolo playing, that I can't imagine hearing a bar order across a loud bar and getting it right, let alone doing that for several hours in an evening.
You know, like I said, I'm working at a club right now, and I work my entire shift with earplugs in.
And you hear the drinks, all right.
You know, you learn to read lips.
Oh.
Yeah. So I read lips, and I also, because I'm a performer, I don't want to blow my voice, so I don't even speak. I just lip things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
So what does the audience see when they see you on stage at the Marsh?
You know, it's interesting to try and describe, because I think my style is very particular. It's not a monologue. It's a play, and I'm playing mostly men, but I've got, you know, all these characters at the bar, and so I'm switching rapidly between them. There's no time for sort of set changes or costume changes, so I think it's really an experience, and it keeps people on their toes and really paying attention. And so that's what you're going to see. You're going to see me playing mostly men and then the bartender.
Okay, so you're transferring in different characters as the play evolves.
Yes. I mean, I introduce them from the get-go.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What is it? Well, let's go this way. What's your favorite bar in San Francisco?
Ooh, gosh.
Let's start with this way, where you've worked.
Oh, my favorite bar that I've worked? Wow, that's a tough one. You know, I really loved working at the Fillmore. That was one of my favorites. I've done sort of dive bars, and then I've done clubs. That's sort of the two that I've done a lot of, and I do love clubs. In terms of bars, I'd say Vertigo was a favorite on Polk Street, and Hobson's Choice and the Hate was really fun because of the neighborhood, and the owners were lovely people.
Mm-hmm. And what qualities does a barmaid have to be a successful? I mean, you've gone through 28 bars or so. Let's ask why. First of all, there have been so many. You mentioned that some of these were for like almost one night stands. It just the atmosphere wasn't right for you, or
yeah, you know, I mean, I think I have a little bit of an attitude, and I might not be the easiest person to. I'm not laid back. Exactly. So if something doesn't work out for me, it doesn't work out pretty fast. It's not going to be like, I'm going to suck it up for a year or two. It's just like, this isn't working. And I don't respond well to getting yelled at by owners. So that's a pretty quick one. You yell at me on the first day and it's like, there's no reason for that. Yeah. I'm a grown up. You're a grown up. Take it out on your kids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that happens to me all the time is I fall for the bartender.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's a man. Now, I imagine you might get hit on by members of both sexes in your role as a bartender. Is it just a simple, thanks, I'm with someone? Or
it's not. It's awkward.
Yeah.
It tends to be awkward, unless it's very, you know, it's most awkward if it's an attractive person. It's much less awkward if it's just your typical jerk.
Imagine there are a few of those.
Yeah, a couple.
Uh-huh. No, in San Francisco? Come on.
Yeah, there's a few. Yeah, you know, you kind of just get immune to it. I mean, and you just sort of, I have a boyfriend is an easy one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, you were asking what makes makes a person a successful bartender. And it's really, for me, it's just been about my boobs.
Okay.
Yeah. I find that boobs will get you the job whether or not you know how to bartend. I mean, that's how I got into it before I actually knew how. I just lied and said I knew how, and then I just had my boobs out. So not all the way out, you know, just enough. I can say boobs on the air, right?
You can, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So
now, actually, that reminds me of one of the great Herb Cain lines of history. You remember Herb Cain?
Yes.
In San Francisco? His line was, a martini is like a woman's breasts. One is not enough, and three are too many.
That is good.
My favorite Herb Cain.
That is good. I actually have a bit in my piece where there's sort of, I call her Mrs. Duggar on the script, but you don't actually know that. But there's sort of this woman with breast almost like tentacles, like she's got like a million breasts. Because I do these breakaway scenes from the actual narrative at the bar that have sort of commentary and stuff, and they're very cartoony and big and lively. And one of them is this breast woman who's got all of the bar patrons on her teats.
Very nice. Now, being a bartendress, you must have some good bar jokes.
No, I don't.
Are you kidding? Well, use that one. Use that one.
Which one? Oh, yes, yes, the Herb Cain.
And
yes.
Then there's always the Dorothy Parker one. You know, the Dorothy Parker
Which
anecdote.
One is that?
It's like, I like a good martini, two at the very most. After three, I'm under the table. After four, I'm under the host.
Ooh, I like it.
And then there's, you know, the horse walks into a bar. You must have some jokes
like
that.
I don't have any bar jokes, and I feel like a failure because of it, David. I really do.
We'll have to talk afterwards. I'll give you a
couple. Yeah,
yeah. Well, the obvious one is, a baby seal walks into a bar.
Uh-huh.
The bartender says, hey, what'll it be, baby seal? And the baby seal says, anything but a Canadian club.
Oh.
They get worries. They get worries.
I know they do. I know they do. People tell me jokes all the time, and I don't know why I don't remember them. I have, like, the joke center in my brain is, like, defunct. I don't know. It's very interesting.
All right. Two more for you, and these will be easy to remember. So these two bunny rabbits are sitting at the bar talking to each other.
Mm-hmm. As bunny rabbits do.
Yeah, as they do. And a horse walks into the bar and asks the bartender. The bartender says, what'll it be? And the horse says, just give me a gin and tonic. And one bunny looks at the other one and says, wow, look at that, a talking horse.
That is a good one. I like that one.
Or you know, if you want to go into the science realm of physics, you know, a proton walks into a bar and the bartender says, what'll it be, proton? Just give me a double bourbon. Double bourbon? It's only 10 in the morning. And the proton says, what? The bartender says, are you sure about that? I said, I'm positive. Proton, you got to be in a science geeky kind of. I've told it bad.
And I am geeky, but I'm more on the airhead side, so that took me a minute.
So we will not expect bar jokes at Tipped and Tipsy. We'll have some character studies, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely a comedy. You know, I brought in a little clip.
Please, I'd love to hear more.
Yeah? Okay. So one of the regulars has just gotten cut off, and he's trying to sort of fight for his rights, let's say. So this is Pat. Let me ask you something. Am I the first guy to ever fall off his bar stool? Wait a minute. I seem to remember Rico falling off his bar stool just last week. Whoa. You fell off because you were having a seizure. I fell off because I was drunk. It's a little different, Pat. Yeah? All right. Well, why didn't you cut off Ernest when he fell off his bar stool on President's Day?
I'm sorry. I don't remember that.
Yeah, you bumped into a bunch of girls and you knocked one over. You tried to help her up and then you tore her blouse and called her some curse word none of us had ever heard before.
Strumpet!
I have and continue to have no recollection of blacking out.
All right. Well, why didn't you cut off Ace when he fell off his bar stool on his birthday and twisted his ankle?
Whoa, it really makes you think. What is the magical force that keeps someone on a bar stool?
Nice.
So that's one of the little...
Jill Weiss from Tip to Tipsy, her show at The Marsh. Now, this is yet another David Ford production at
yes.
The Marsh. Tell me what he's done to your work and how he's brought it to life on the stage.
He is just incredible. He's just incredible to work with. You know, he's listed as my director, but he's not just my director. He co-created it with me. It's him, me, and Dave Dennison. But David Ford, it began with him. He sort of coached me into actually telling the story, which wasn't necessarily a story at first. He just wanted to hear a little bit about it. And so I did the first 15 minutes, and he said, let's keep going. You know, and he sits there, and he listens to what you've got. You know, you bring something in that's no good, and he listens to it. And eventually his genius just sort of picks up on exactly what it needs. He's like, I got it. You know, we change the order here and you're going to move to this side of the stage. And then it's like, boom, magic happens. And it's like, you just have to keep being diligent about bringing in the work. And then he'll the magic will happen. Like, he will see something. He'll get a vision, you know? And it's just been, I've been working with him at least weekly for 3 years, mm-hmm. Over 2.5 on this piece. So he's just, he understands the sort of spirit of the artist and understands how to work with you and really nurture your tender soul.
David Ford directing Jill Weiss in Tipped and Tipsy at the Marsh. It runs through April 6th, information at themarsh.org. Jill, before you go, I want you to maybe share a little bit of details about your touring the UK with a punk rock group. I mentioned early on in your bio, you've got quite a diverse portfolio going on, but yes. You toured the UK as lead singer and guitarist in a punk group called Chester. How did that come about?
Well, you know, I wanted to drop out of art school because I was afraid I wouldn't make a living as an artist. But I didn't have the nerve because I knew it would upset my parents. So I said, I'm just going to go to the UK for a little leave of absence. And then I was hooked. I started bartending. I was, you know, in my 20s and early 20s. Actually, I wasn't 20 yet. Anyway, I started bartending there. Oh, yes, it was just last year. And I auditioned for some punk bands and I got into this one and it was an incredible experience, you know. I say singing, but it was more like screaming, and it was just a great group of guys, and we, you know, toured England and the UK and went through just lots of little garages and basements and clubs, and it was quite an experience.
Band still together, or is it just a one-time shot?
I believe they still are. Yeah, they stayed together for quite a while. I need to reach out to them again, but I know that they're definitely doing other things. I mean, the main guy, Rob Bartram, from the UK, is just like a punk rock sort of icon in the UK. So check him out if you're into punk rock. Mm-hmm.
Still ambitions in that direction? Or are you more along the bartender route and playwright?
I'd say playwright route.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you, David.
A little music to go out with you for some tequila to go out. Jill Weiss's Tipped and Tipsy is at The Marsh through April 6th. Information at themarsh.org. Jill, thanks for taking some time today.
Thank you.
Touch of Tequila, performed by Wes Montgomery on his birthday. Thanks to producer Niels Swinkels for pointing that out and bringing that excerpt in. Some familiar music on the way from Duane Carroll and the Contra Costa Wind Symphony. And we'll be talking with Joshua Cosman, it being the first of the month, about some classical picks for the month of March. Thank you. Just a touch of what might be familiar to some ears, Ferdy Grofe's Grand Canyon Suite, which will receive its West Coast premiere in a new transcription for Wind Symphony. California-born conductor Duane Carroll has been music director and conductor of the Contra Costa Wind Symphony since 1981. He holds degrees in music from San Francisco State University and the University of Michigan. At the U.S. Naval Academy, U.S. Naval School of Music, he played clarinet, saxophone, and oboe, and did some stints in some Army bands in Atlanta, Georgia, and the Armored Division Band, 4th Armored Division Band in Germany. It's a pleasure to welcome Duane as conductor of the Contra Costa Wind Symphony to Open Air. Hi, Duane.
Hi, David. Thank you much for having me here.
Of course. This program is called Mountains and Canyons. You're sharing the podium with Ben Luber for this program called Mountains and Canyons. It includes, as I mentioned, the Grand Canyon Suite and a special wind symphony arrangement. Steve Reinecke's Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait, which we'll hear a little bit of before we're done. And Satoshi Yagasawa's Machu Picchu, City in the Sky. And an arrangement of Shenandoah. This sounds like a really very visual audio concert.
That's right. That's one of the things that I was really attracted to with Stephen Reinecke's writing, is that he really paints symphonic portraits of places that he's been. And so it kind of came together from that.
Uh-huh. So let's back up and talk about the history of the Contra Costa Wind Symphony. You've been director since 1981. Is that when it was founded, or does it go back farther than that?
Well, it was 1 year before that it started. It was actually a class through Okolonis Adult Education. And the first person, they wanted to have a community band, and so the director found somebody that would take it over for a year to get it started, one of the local music dealers. And after that, it was opened up, and I got the appointment. Mm-hmm. So it started from there.
How often does the how many concerts per season?
We usually have about 5 concerts per season. We rehearse once a week for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. So, in Walnut Creek?
In Walnut Creek, yes.
How is the personnel decided upon? Has it been a fairly steady core of musicians? How many are in the symphonic orchestra?
Now there's about 50. It started out in that 1981, there was about 25 people, so it grew as a community band, and then eventually transitioned into be more of a symphonic band playing more serious literature. Mm-hmm. So through that period of time, people that were interested in doing a little bit more serious symphonic band music started to gather toward the group, and so we restructured a few years ago and made it more of an indoor concert on stage kind of group. Mm-hmm. So it's gathered some really outstanding amateur musicians through the years, and probably the last 10, 15 years, it has had pretty much the same people in there, and it's grown.
There aren't that many symphonic wind ensembles in the area, are there?
There's not.
On the professional level.
There's a very few. There are a lot of community bands, but the bands that really are into more serious literature, there's not very many of them in the Bay Area at all.
Mm-hmm. So you rehearse weekly then in Walnut Creek?
That's right.
Fantastic. And this program, Mountains and Canyons, talk to us how that evolved into a full program. Who's involved in creating the themed programs for this symphony?
Well, one of the people there, Randy Bass, Shenandoah arrangement. I had known him for some time and had him out here as a guest conductor, composer. I've done some of his works. He's really a great orchestrator and composer. He's done a lot of things for the military bands in Washington. And so he had told me that he had done this full transcription of the Grand Canyon Suite, and there had only been previously one movement published.
That seems so astonishing. In 80 years of existence of Ferdy Grofe's work for full orchestra, that it's never been transcribed into a wind arrangement.
Only one movement.
Only one
so
movement.
So this is rather unique that Randy has done this. And so that was kind of the catalyst for looking at this program. And I knew we had Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait, in the library, and the Machu Picchu. So it just kind of grew from there, evolved from that idea to become mountains and canyons.
Mm-hmm. Ben Loomer will be conducting too. Who is Ben, and why is he conducting, sharing the podium with you on this concert?
He's a trumpet player in the group, uh-huh. and he's also a middle school band instructor at Stone Valley Middle School in Alamo, and a very, very fine musician, and so wanted him to help out on this concert.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Stephen Reinecke's piece, Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait. How did that come about?
We were approaching our 20th anniversary, and we wanted to commission a work, something having to do with the local area. And I had become familiar with Stephen's writing, and the thing that I really like about him is that he's a great melodist. I mean, he can write a nice tune, and he enjoys writing about places that he's visited. In other words, kind of composing this symphonic portrait. And so we invited him out. He was out here, and the Mount Diablo Interpretive Association, a fellow by the name of Frank Valeriestra, took Steve and I hiking on the mountain and told us all kinds of history and lore of the mountain. Mm-hmm. And Steve wrote this beautiful piece.
You know, I've been here going on 12 years now, and I still have not met him up to Mount Diablo. So I'm hoping that this piece will inspire me to do so. Let's talk about it. It's a four-movement work. The first movement is called Ascension and Eagle Flight. And personal bias, I love the fact that it opens up with a solo alto flute.
I thought you might like that.
Tell me about that movement.
Well, this is one of the movements, as all of them, actually, that I have this really beautiful melody in there, and it opens up with an alto flute and kind of conjuring up the thought of ancient times, and with that particular kind of sound, it's just very, very soothing, but at the same time it gets us into the mood of the piece, the Native American chant-like call.
Mm-hmm. And we go into a movement called Spirit of the Ancients after that.
Yes, that has to do with the Bay Miwok Native Americans that have lived within the mountain or within the site of the mountain for the last 5,000 years. And it's just a very kind of a conjuring up this idea of ancient times and the spirit of the Indians.
The third movement is called Arachnia. We're going to hear a little bit of that, and then we'll visit a little bit more. Let's set up for our audience what they would be hearing in the third movement, Arachnia, from Mount Diablo.
Well, in the fall, the tarantulas come out. And
maybe I'm glad that I haven't visited Mount Diablo.
Maybe you might like to. So the tarantulas come out, and they're all over the place. I mean, you just walk on the paths, and you can see them going, and they're looking. It's the time of the year for mating, and they're looking for a mate. And in the music, you can hear this, when he finds a trap door of the female, you can hear this tapping on the trap door. And then...
Well, I'm glad there are no visuals involved in radio then, if this is a mating ritual.
Probably a good thing.
Okay, let's hear a little bit. This is from Arachnia, from Steve Reinecke's Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait. Thank you. And the mating ritual begins for the Arachnia movement of Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait. That was the Contra Costa Wind Symphony performing under the direction of the composer Stephen Reinecke back in 2002. Thanks for sharing that, Duane. It sounds like a lot of fun movement there. So also on the program, I mentioned that Satoshi's Yagisawa's Machu Picchu, City in the Sky, is on the program. How did you come across that work?
I go to a conference in Chicago each year, and one of the publishers there had samples of new works that were out. And I had talked with this fellow several times and told him the kind of orchestration that I like, the things that I'm looking for. And this just seemed to be a really very, very fine work. It's full orchestration and a very, very exciting piece. Gets into some of the history of the mountain and some of the battles that took place there. And there's one thing, there's this beautiful melody that's going on, orchestration, and all of a sudden little things start happening that get very dissonant. And it's this encroaching of the people getting ready to do battle. So people might think it's they're playing a lot of wrong notes in here, but it's not. It's just the dissonance of this thing that's about to happen. So it's a very, very exciting piece.
Yagisawa's Machu Picchu will be conducted by Ben Loomer, as will Randall Allen Bass's arrangement of Shenandoah, and the world premiere of the full Ferdy Groffet Grand Canyon Suite. Let's get back to the featured work, Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait that you'll be conducting, and just set up the last movement for us. But Duane, first of all, I'd like to say thanks for coming to spend some time on Open Air, and that you can find information for the concert at lesherartscenter.org. It's this Sunday at 7:30. So the fourth movement, Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait, Creation of the Sun. What are we going to hear? What are we going to hear in that moment?
Well, this piece has to do with an ancient myth of Tulelu is the white-footed mouse, and he stole fire from the neighboring tribe. And one night he crept in their village and lulled them to sleep with the playing of his flute. And when they were asleep, he stole the precious fire and stored it in his flute. And when he arrived home, he placed the fire on the ground and covered it with leaves and pine needles, and then Ulachu, the coyote, smelled the fire and wanted to steal it for himself. So when he approached the mound and prepared to swallow it, the fire suddenly shot up into the sky, thus creating the sun.
Interesting.
That's
the
myth.
Where is the myth from? What culture? Is it also the Miwok? Or?
Yes, I believe so.
Oh, interesting. So this is the Creation of the Sun from Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait, a work by Stephen Reinecke that you can hear this Sunday at 7:30 at the Lesher Arts Center. Information at lesherartscenter.org. Duane, thanks for taking some time with us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much, David.
A lovely excerpt indeed from Mount Diablo, a symphonic portrait, the creation of the sun. Again, that full work can be heard this Sunday as part of the Contra Costa Wind Symphony's program Mountains and Canyons at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek. Information at lesherartscenter.org. On the podium, Dwayne Carroll and Ben Loomer. First Thursday of the month open-air feature is a visit with Joshua Cosman, critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Joshua, welcome back, and let's hear what's on your pick list for the month of March.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back. March is full of musical pleasures and surprises coming up. It's a little bit light in some respects in that the San Francisco Symphony will be on tour in Europe this month. So none of that going on this month. After this weekend, they sort of say goodbye and sail off across the ocean, or fly, I guess.
Well, naturally, they invited you to review the different stops, right?
Yes. I'm going to go on the QE2, so I'll be a little behind. But in fact, I'll be here covering. There will be a number of really first-rate orchestras that are coming to town in their absence, one of which, of course, is the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, which returns this weekend, 3 years after they made their original appearance in Berkeley under the aegis of Cal Performances for the first time in 20 years, I should say. This time they'll be coming for three separate concerts under three different conductors.
Is there a ruse behind that, having three different conductors?
I think they're just kind of mixing it up for the sake of the audiences and for the sake of the musicians, as far as I know.
All right.
So the weekend of March 7th, 8th, and 9th will be a big Vienna blowout in Berkeley. Opening night conducted by Lauren Mazel. That was supposed to be Daniele Gatte, and he had to pull out because of medical condition. And so Lauren Mazel is going to step in to conduct Schubert and Mahler. Then Saturday, March 8th, we'll have Andras Nelsons, who's the new music director designate in Boston at the Boston Symphony. He's going to conduct Haydn and Brahms. And finally, on Sunday afternoon, March 9th, Franz Welsermust, who has a long connection with this orchestra, will conduct Mozart and Bruckner, and also a new piece by the young Austrian composer Johannes Maria Staud, something called On Comparative Meteorology. So that'll be and also that second program conducted by Andras Nelsons will be then repeated on the following Tuesday at Green Music Center in Rohnert Park.
Terrific. Information on those concerts at calperformances.org. Joshua, I'm curious about your comparison, if you do comparisons between, say, the San Francisco Symphony and the Vienna Philharmonic. What do you hear as the main differences between orchestras?
Well, that's a good question. And I would say any comparisons between orchestras is going to be tentative, especially between those two, because one I hear week in and week out, and one I hear every few years when they come to town. But certainly the Vienna Philharmonic has a distinctive sound quality that is rooted in its tradition as part of as the sort of the center of Austrian culture. And so there's a very kind of smooth and rich sound that they've cultivated and they've promoted over many years. San Francisco Symphony, in a way, is a reflection of the character of its music director, as many an orchestra is. Of course, the Vienna Phil doesn't have a music director, so it's a little more protean. But the San Francisco Symphony, like its music director, Michael Tilson-Thomas, has that kind of spontaneity and energy and verve that I think really makes it quite distinctive as a performing group.
Hmm. Speaking of great orchestras, we have the LA Phil coming to town.
Yes, the LA Phil. Also, speaking of spontaneity and verve, the young music director Gustavo Dudamel will lead his band here in Davies for two nights. On March 11th, he's going to conduct the Corigliano Symphony No. 1, a wonderful piece, a memorial to the victims of the AIDS plague, and Tchaikovsky Fifth Symphony. And then the following night on March 12th, the great Yuja Wang will be the soloist in the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto. They're going to do Brahms Second and a piece by the Icelandic composer Daniel Bjarnason, something called Blow Bright, which they just premiered in Los Angeles earlier this year, which I'm looking forward to hearing.
Fantastic. Information on that on sfsymphony.org.
Then getting away from the world of orchestral music, as one wants to do sometimes, I want to put in a plug for a really interesting-looking program coming to the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts on March 21st and 22nd, featuring the cellist Maya Beiser, who's a very gifted and dynamic performer, and also very imaginative in her programming. She used to be the cellist with the Bang on a Can All-Stars, which was the performing ensemble that was associated with the New York New Music Ensemble Festival, rather, Bang on a Can. And since going out on her own, she's done a lot of very interesting commissions and explorations of new music by a range of composers. This program is called All Thous, which is a English translation of Kol Nidre, the prayer that's recited in synagogues around the world on the first night of on the night of Yom Kippur. And for that, she's got two pieces, one by the American Jewish composer Michael Gordon and another by the Arab-American composer Mohammed Fairouz, both of them based on thematic materials associated with that prayer.
So Fairouz is getting quite a bit of coverage lately.
He has. Young. He's very interesting, a very dynamic young composer whose music I think is greatly of importance. And also on that program, she's going to be doing a collection of arrangements of rock and blues pieces by Led Zeppelin, Howling Wolf, Janis Joplin, Nirvana, and Robert Johnson by the composers Evan Zipporin and David T. Little. I spoke to my advisor recently for a story that I'm doing for the paper, and she talked about the importance of Janis Joplin in particular to her development as an artist.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and it's sort of as a hint of what one could be as a performing artist.
Well, it's nice to see a program that is so innovative.
Exactly. And finally on that program is a piece by Steve Reich written for her and a piece by Michael Harrison called Just Ancient Loops.
Let's hear a track of a bit of Michael Harrison's Just Ancient Loops, and then we'll be back with Joshua Cosman with more of his picks for March. Thank you. Just Ancient Loops, an excerpt of Michael Harrison's piece that will be performed by cellist Maya Beiser at Yerba Buena Center for the Performing Arts. Information about that concert on the 21st and 22nd at ybca.org. That's a great pick, Joshua.
Thank you. Also on that same weekend, the New Century Chamber Orchestra, which just did a collaboration last month with the singers of the San Francisco Opera Center, is now doing another one, this time with the singers of Chanticleer. They're going to be collaborating on a program called Atlantic Crossing, which focuses on music from Europe and America in the periods between the wars. So starting in Europe with music by Bartok, Miklos Rocha, and Fritz Kreisler, European-trained musicians who then ended up in the United States, and a lot of Kurt Weill from the early European period. Then there'll be sort of an interim period, which is representing a boat ride across the Atlantic as we cross from Europe to America, and winding up with more Kurt Weill and music by George Gershwin and Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn. So that's the New Century.
I guess it won't be take the A train if it's across the Atlantic then.
Well, once you get across the Atlantic and you're firmly in New York, you can definitely take the A train.
There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, there's a curse.
You're all over the transportation music. I like that. So that's a program that's being done on March 20th at Bing Center in Stanford, March 21st and 22nd at San Francisco Conservatory, the 23rd at the Osher Marin JCC in San Rafael, and on the 25th in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church.
New Century Chamber Orchestra website, ncco.org. Also at chanticleer.org, some information about those concerts.
Finally, just to wind up a little bit, for those who have a more traditional approach and are interested in piano music, we've got a number of really good-looking piano recitals coming this month. Angela Hewitt, the wonderful British pianist, is going to play Bach's Art of Fugue in complete and straight through on March 9th at the SF Jazz Center. Hmm. That's a concert presented by San Francisco Performances.
Performances.org for Angela Hewitt at SF Jazz. Neat.
And on the 20th in Davies Symphony Hall, the pianist Evgeny Kissin will be back. He's appearing under the aegis of San Francisco Symphony. He's going to play a program of Schubert and Scriabin. He just did a recital in Washington at the Kennedy Center a few weeks ago in which he apparently recited large chunks of Yiddish poetry from memory. Apparently we don't get that here, but we take what we can get, and he's always a welcome visitor to these stages.
Indeed, again, that's the 20th of this month at Davies. Information at the Symphony's website, sfsymphony.org.
And finally, the great Mitsuko Uchida will be coming to Berkeley, thanks to Cal Performances. She'll be performing in Hertz Hall on March 25th. She's going to play Schubert, and she's going to play the Beethoven Diabelli Variations. So always a wonderful opportunity to hear her play. That's at calperformances.org.
Well, it sounds like March is coming in like a lion and going out like a devil, if that's the, that's the case.
That's very true. It's very
your calendar. Wow.
Exactly so.
Well, Joshua, thank you for these picks. It sounds like a very robust month indeed.
I'm sure it will be. Thanks so much for having me, David.
See you next month. And that's Open Air for this week. A reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. You can send me, David LaTulipe, a note about this show, maybe suggest a guest for a future edition of Open Air at kalw.org. My email address is david@kalw.org. Thanks again to Niels Swinkels for producing today's show, and some special technical assistance today from Ron Seeley. BBC NewsHour is next here on Local Public Radio. The time is 2 o'clock.